Hello, and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, scholar Thomas A. Tweed discusses his new book, Religion and the Lands That Became America, a sweeping retelling of American religious history. He is joined by fellow Indigenous Studies professor John N. Lau. This conversation originally took place November 10th, 2025, and was recorded live at the American Writers Museum. This episode is presented in conjunction with the American Writers Museum's new special exhibit, American Prophets, Writers, Religion, and Culture. This exhibit and our programming series explores the profound ways writing reflects and influences our understanding of religion. American Prophets is now open. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
How are we all doing tonight?
Good.
All right. I want to welcome everyone to the American Writers Museum. I'm the president here, Kerry Cranston, and if you enjoy the types of programs that we have here at the American Writers Museum, you can join us and become a member by going to AmericanWritersMuseum.org or signing up with our staff at the front desk. You'll get free museum admission as well as advance access to new events and exhibits, including American Prophets, Writers, Religion, and Culture, which is our next exhibit that opens November 21st. And we're gathered today on the traditional, ancestral, and unceded land of the Council of the Three Fires, the Ojibwe, Odawa, and Potawatomi nations. Many other tribes, such as the Miami, Ho-Chunk, Menominee, Sac, and Fox, also called this area home. I ask you to join me in acknowledging these communities, their elders, both past and present, as well as future generations. Throughout its content, the American Writers Museum strives to acknowledge that the history of this country extends long before colonial ships landed on these shores. Our nation's first storytellers showed us their deep connections to one another, to the places they called home, and to the faith traditions that shaped them. We're here tonight to learn more about religion in the land that became America, the subject of our guest, Dr. Thomas Tweed's most recent book. It's a retelling that begins at a rock shelter in present-day Texas and follows indigenous peoples, African Americans, transnational migrants, and people of many faiths as they transform the landscape and confront the big lifeway transitions from foraging to farming and from factories to fiber optics. Dr. Tweed is the Harold and Martha Welch Professor of American Studies and Professor of History at the University of Notre Dame, a past president of the American Academy of Religion. He is editor of Retelling U.S. Religious History and author of Crossing and Dwelling, A Theory of Religion and Religion, A Very Short Introduction. He's here in conversation with Dr. John Lau, an award-winning author who received his PhD in American culture at the University of Michigan and is an enrolled citizen of the Pokagon Band of the Potawatomi Indians. He is professor emeritus from The Ohio State University and a retired director of the university's Newark Earthworks Center. Sir, he serves on the board of directors of the Chicago History Museum as well, and so please welcome both of them.
Thank you very much for that kind introduction. And thank you, everyone, for coming tonight. And thank you to those of you who are on Zoom. Hopefully, we will speak loudly, speak clearly, and say something that means something to someone tonight. It's my pleasure to be in conversation with my good friend and colleague, Thomas Tweed, who I shall call Tom. And so. Oh,
sounds right.
He's written another great book. And so we're honored to be able to chat with him tonight. And so if you're ready, I've got a list of questions.
I don't know any of these questions, by the way. Just to let you know.
And that is true. So what is the origin story of your book?
I was an undergraduate and I read the classic story of Religion in America, one that had won the National Book Award. It was a great book. It just didn't have anything to do with what I understood as religion. It wasn't anything I saw in my Catholic parish, in my friend's synagogues. It started kind of late and it didn't have much to do with ordinary people, weekday religion, the things I knew. And I thought, that's a lovely story, but we probably should think about other ones. And as I went off to graduate school, I had more questions and more worries. It talked about slavery, but it didn't really talk much about the piety of enslaved people. It talked about how slavery affected Protestant churches. It talked about indigenous peoples, but erased most of the history before Columbus and much of it after that. And so, and it did deal with some problems, some social kind of problems, but I thought, I wonder if we could actually write a story that dealt with more problems, that dealt with more people, and was a little bit more inclusive. And so I decided early on after I graduated, got a PhD, that I would write the story. That it took a couple of decades, but that's the basically the origin story. Then I just had to figure out how to do that.
Excellent. Well, I can say as a Native person, Indigenous person, I'm a member of the Pokagon Potawatomi Indians, that I found it really refreshing that you broadened the idea of religion in the Americas long before the Puritans, and really sort of allowed us to think about what was going on before settler colonialism. It's a really good read, this book. I would recommend it highly to everyone. So you mentioned in the introduction that you have blind spots, that we all have blind spots, but yourself included. What do you mean? And were you able to identify any of those as you wrote this book?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, part of what's wonderful about the question, and thanks for the kind words about it, John, I think all authors have blind spots. Some say so and some don't. Some are, you know, acknowledge it in some ways. And one of my worries about the way stories were told, not only was it, it didn't, many people didn't feel represented in the story, but also I thought they acted, they were all kind of omniscient God's eye narrators telling the story from some other perspective. They were never located in a particular place and time, but I think all stories are kind of sightings from sights, are what you can see from a particular place. And a point I made along the way to this book, I mean, I think by the end, I thought I have almost nothing but blind spots, to be honest, because I realized I didn't know nearly enough about almost anything, so I thought that was a good place to start. And I do quote, there's a moment when Sidney Ahlstrom, who was a great historian who wrote that, the classic famous one, who actually gets humble at some point too and says, if, you know, I don't know everything, but I didn't know enough about what happened before Columbus. I didn't know, I had done things about immigrants for a long time. I'd written about Latinos. I'd written about Asian Americans. I felt like I knew something about the Pacific world. I knew something about later centuries, but I didn't know what kind of organizing themes to use. How do we get everybody in? We can't say the rise and fall of Puritans. If we say that, that's what he said. We're talking about men, churches, New England, books. We're not talking about the woman in my parish, who's kneeling before the altar of Mary, tearing up, praying for who knows what. I mean, she's out of that story, and lots of other people were out of it. But I especially spent a lot of years thinking, if I want to start it earlier, when do I start, where do I start, and how do I figure out how to do that? And that was a blind spot then, and it's still a blind spot, I think.
Fascinating. Well, I think it'll be a really refreshing read for audiences that are don't have access to information about, you know, this is not something taught in our school systems. It's not something widely available. It's not even something that Indigenous peoples, you know, it's not in our DNA. And so much of that information has been lost. And so it's really refreshing to see how you're working through that and sharing that and elaborating on that. So I say, Miigwech, thank you to you for appreciate doing that. So your book, this book, continues the important work you did in your last book, of thinking about themes of crossing, moving, and dwelling. Really cool stuff, really smart. And can you elaborate for the audience, both here and at home? Can you elaborate on those ideas? And what are the implications of thinking about those themes as far as religion and the study of religion?
Yeah, thanks so much, John. I basically, at some point, I was living in Miami. I was going to write something else. Then I went to this small shrine where Cuban Catholics went, and I was stunned. There's a Cuban flag. There's a mural. I talked to people. Almost everyone cried, and I started to think, maybe I should write about this. And after I wrote that book, which was called Our Lady of the Exile, I thought the theories about religion and what it is and what it does didn't make any sense of those immigrants. They were all too static. So how do we put religion in motion? How do we actually think about what was important to them? Religion and practice and the tears, emotion as well as cognition, and moving as well as setting put. So I began with that thought and then wrote another theory of religion, which was I thought was so weird and odd that I didn't really explain it to everyone. I didn't say anything public. My editor at Harvard Press said, don't talk to anybody about it. I couldn't tell whether this was because she was so embarrassed and mortified by it or whether she thought I should keep it to myself, but I didn't say anything. I didn't even know how to describe it because it wasn't exactly like any other book about that. But I basically suggested that religion was about moving across and settling down in the cosmos, in the homeland, in the body. And that was a kind of a framework that got in more people again. Some of the same people I was trying to get into this story, meaning I had little notes for myself as I wrote on index cards, like who to get in, women. If I was done and you couldn't find any way of talking about women, it was terrible and I should start again, for example. So that was the idea behind it, was to put religion in motion in some kind of way, I think. Then at some point I thought, when I turned to this one, what kind of themes would I use to organize something? Every narrative has an organizing theme. Again, whether the narrator tells you that or not, or whether you can extract it. That's the kind of thing that 10th grade English teachers drive you nuts by saying, like, what's the organizing theme of this novel or that one? But they actually do have organizing themes. And I thought the ones that people had used before just didn't capture enough. So I thought maybe crossing and dwelling would work. And they sort of worked until I started to think, I don't want to anticipate where you're going, but I started to realize about halfway through, and I should have just pushed on and closed my eyes and finished the book. It took me about 13 years to write this. I would have been done in half the time, probably. But at halfway through, I thought, the problem is, I wanted to think about how things cross and dwell and how displacement and emplacement, those are the two themes. People are moving and are finding a place. But what I started to think about was, in a particular place, some places are more sustainable than others. Some places allow human flourishing, individual, communal, and environmental flourishing more than others. So I really need to start, I need to introduce those themes too, and think about sustainability and flourishing, which meant I started again and rewrote what I had and pushed on.
So you have a couple, adult person and a younger child, and it involves the Horn Shelter. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, the Horn Shelter, Horn Shelter number 2, if you go to Baylor University and you see an old museum there, they actually have an exhibit. It turns out I gave a talk. They were kind enough to invite me to talk there. And I thought everybody was going to know about the Horn Shelter, but it turns out they did not, even though there was an exhibit on campus about it. As I began to think, where do you start the story? You can't start it when religion started in some ancient misty past. You have to figure out, I decided I had to think through how and where to start it. And I went and talked to archaeologists and anthropologists at Oxford and tried out this idea. I figured I'm across the ocean. If it sucks, nobody will notice. What if you first sort of think about what are the conditions for the possibility of religion? The capacity for making symbols, for thinking in analogies, for doing whatever religious folks did. And now, when do we first find evidence of that in the archaeological record, in stuff that archaeologists dug up from the ground? And I spent years thinking about all the places that archaeologists had excavated and thought that the best site was this place in central Texas, about 18 miles from Waco. I think there's some TV show about Waco and housing and something like this that I've learned since visiting there. And it was basically a burial of a clearly revered older man, meaning 40s, and a young girl. And I had the good fortune to talk to an anthropologist, I won't identify where she was and everything, who actually saw the bones and was as obsessed with her as I was. Like, how old was she? Why is she there? Just on the cusp between, just on the edge of puberty, not quite, kind of girl on the threshold, pretty young. And then you look at what was offered by the San Patrice people who honored them by burying them meticulously in a grave next to each other. She had just one thing, a bone, a kind of needle for sewing hides and things, whereas he had more than 100 objects around him, the older man. And I thought, it was animal images. I thought, here are symbols. This is kind of myth making. They're thinking about the beginning of things. They're thinking about what happens when people die. Okay, this is the start of the story, even though I didn't know really anything about how to talk about that or enough, but I went and traveled to people and talked to the folks who had done analysis of all of that. And so they're the double burial. It's, we now think, a shaman or a medicine man, because he's buried with the stuff that for centuries after that, religious leaders of communities would have had, like red ochre. You could actually see where he scraped out some red ochre and he applied it to either in a funeral or for healing or for other kinds of things. So I thought we have kind of spiritual tools and a holy man, and we should start it there.
And so that segues well into my next question. At least what I've been exposed to, so much of Western history anyway, is divided up into eras or ages based upon the technology or the materials that were being used. But you've got a really exciting and a fascinating way of thinking about human history in a different way, and the way that religion participates in it, reflects, contributes to that. Can you share with the audience?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things, as you know well, is that religion is not always a category for all indigenous folks. Some people would say, yeah, that's not our word. I wanted language that made sense to both contemporary indigenous folks and made sense of longer history. And Lifeway, or way of life, is a kind of way of talking that I found when I tested it out with lots of friends, including you,
yes,
that sort of made some sense. So I then thought, how do we talk about the shifts in Lifeways, or way of life, over a long period? So we're not talking about before Columbus, after Columbus, here comes a war, there's a president. We're organizing it a completely different way. And I thought, well, what are the major ways of life and the kind of spirituality associated with each? And I decided, so the book is organized into four sections: foraging, hunting, gathering things, farming, factories, and fiber optics. So that seems to me the structure. And now in each case, the metaphors, the way, the symbols that were associated with those ways of life were part of how folks lived. And you can now figure out how did ordinary folks and elites deal with these transitions, and how did they use religious tools to make things better and sometimes to make it worse?
And try to make sense.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You've mentioned earlier tonight, Tom, about sustainability, and you referred to these crises of sustainability. How does that frame your work?
And I'm in sustainability studies and peace studies at Notre Dame too. So I was already thinking, I taught a class called Sustainable America, which dealt with racial justice, environmental justice, and economic justice. But I was already thinking that sustainability didn't mean what the environmental folks thought, only about climate or something, or environmental sustainability. And real flourishing and fully sustainable spot has to be socially sustainable, has to be a sustainable governance, and it has to be a kind of sustainable in terms of the wider environment too. And then as I went back at that moment, when I was thinking to myself, I actually would walk in, my poor wife is over here, I would walk out and say, I cannot write this book, no one can write this book, what was I thinking? And why did I start again? But I basically thought I had to go back and think, now, what kind of, I use niche theory from biologists, like think of a beaver's dam. So if we reorganize the space of what is now the lands that became America into river valleys and arid plateaus and other things, what made them more or less sustainable socially? You have to find not just meaning and belonging, you have to have some power, some participation, you have to have some equity, you have to have health, you have to have safety, not just environmental issues, renewable resources and things like that. As I looked through, I thought there were three major sustainability crises in American history, and I organized it from that. The first one happened before Columbus in both the Southwest near Chaco Canyon and around Cahokia across the river from where St. Louis is. Both of the places got very dense, hierarchical, really focused on growing what they would have called, maize or corn. And it got, we can tell from what happened, a little bit more violent. And eventually people left. So you actually see collapse. And and I thought, well, how did they deal with that? And in that case, indigenous folks in both places kind of scaled down, moved away, got less hierarchical, and actually changed the built environment, how they lived. Pueblo people today still tell a story like this. The big houses of the old place in Chaco Canyon, it just didn't work for. So if you've ever been to the Southwest and you see a kind of an open forum in the middle and folks living in kind of more egalitarian living arrangements, that was part of the solution. We can't do that anymore. So I argue that that first sustainability crisis, which I call a cornfield crisis, was resolved mostly. The other two that followed weren't.
I've been thinking and been talking with colleagues and friends back at Newark Earthworks, Tom, and thinking about this idea of movement and placement. And it seems to me to be a very interesting way to explain what was going on there, what was going on with Hopewell era sites generally across the Ohio River Valley, is that because we have people that are spending a lot of time at a place, very connected to it, very committed to it, but they're also traveling. It's a place of pilgrimage, mm-hmm. But it's back and forth, and it's a place of not only people traveling, but ideas traveling. And the spread, we don't know a lot about what those sites were about, what their ceremonial life was, their spiritual life. We don't even know if it was consistently the same. There's so much that we don't know. But it seems like your ideas are a great way to start framing. We've generally thought of, it's connected to the sky because they are astronomy-oriented places too. Mm-hmm. But that's more about traveling in place also. And so it just creates, you know, a third and a fourth dimension of how, you know, these ideas can really help us perhaps to understand what was going on there. And that particularly excited me. And so what are the takeaways from this book that that you hope for readers?
Part of what I had in my head, I mean, what I hope is that it speaks to whatever moment we're in and whatever you need us to be thinking about, is my honest answer. Part of it is I wanted to make sure, and I thought of undergraduates, I wanted my students who didn't feel part of the story to feel part of the story. One of the reasons it's so moving for you to say that, John, is that I wanted folks in Indigenous communities to say, okay, we could have done better, but we'll live with, but okay, he's thought about things. Both back when I taught in North Carolina and when I taught in Texas and other in Miami and other places, I thought there was a lot of students who did not see themselves. So one of the takeaways I hope is you can actually write a story that brings in more people, more practices, and still have a kind of coherent thing. For this moment, I've been going around the country talking about the book a little bit. And this is the question I'm always asked and try to think about. And some folks would say, I can think of an early American historian, a great one, who basically said, you should just keep talking about niche theories and sustainability and forget all of the national narrative. Just don't even talk about US history at all. I love this new frame, forget everything else. Let's just talk about how we all deal with sustainability. And I tried that out in places. I went to Northern Ireland and talked with places where there's been tension and violence, and tried out with folks, kind of rural farmers. What if we just talked about sustainability for future generations, for the next folks? They all thought that would make sense. So there's a part of me that thinks, let's just change the subject and talk about what are the conditions for everyone flourishing. There's the other side of me that's thinking at this moment in America, we actually have to think about the American historical past in a new way that speaks to people and that makes the world better. And so I've been thinking a lot about what we do differently. And part of my thought is one of the things we could do is, for example, on immigration, this is probably the right city at the right moment to talk about this. I think about immigration and some of the conversation about this in the long-term perspective of this book, to say something like a second-generation citizen belongs, but someone, a hardworking newcomer, doesn't make a lot of sense in the long history of the place, which has been moving and mixing for centuries. In the long perspective of this, everyone's an immigrant. It's just, what time did you get here? And we've all been interacting for a long time. So I think immigration policy comes in a new light from that. And I also think when people think about US history and all the conversations, I'm obsessed with the fact, nobody else cares or notices, next year in 2026 is the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. And we're going to hear a lot of things. I actually anticipated one of them. I wrote a piece a few months ago called Did Washington Really Kneel in Prayer at Valley Forge? No, he didn't. But we've already had appeals to that to justify all kinds of things. So part of my, I think the pitch is, what's the significance? Are there ways we can recover authentic patriotic pasts that are that lead toward peace and not conflict, that make more people belong? And I think there are. So use E Pluribus Unum, the original motto of the United States, not In God We Trust, which was added in the 50s, much later. Don't use spiritual warrior language, so prominent in some evangelical communities today. Choose other kind of metaphors for thinking about what a church is and what a nation is. You think about Jesus' parable of the tares and the wheat. Somebody came when the farmer wasn't there, planted some seeds, planted some weeds among the wheat. We can't tell the difference. Jesus says, let it be. God will sort it out in the end. I think there's a little, that would probably be a good thing if we were just a little less certain that we could tell who's wheat and who's a weed. America would be better.
Well said. What's one thing, at least one thing perhaps, Tom, that you learned about yourself, about the topics that you're covering, about the people that you're working with, that you weren't aware of, or not as clearly aware of as you are now? How has this impacted you?
Well, the indigenous piece has impacted me a lot. I mean, I knew things about that. I had been teaching indigenous history in some way, but I learned much, much more about that, I think. And that's impacted me in all kinds of ways that are quite moving to me, and I won't say much about, but that's one of the things. And I think I learned a lot more about the colonial period and how to put it together and how it fits with later things. And I think that's mostly what I learned the most about. I also learned that I'm really stubborn and I push on even when I shouldn't do it. You can't write this book. It's just not possible, really, honestly, is what I thought. So if you have a project that you're thinking about that you can't possibly do, you should do it anyway. And if it sucks, it sucks. You know, this is what it is. But I think I learned that I had a high tolerance for persisting, because I had this sense, dog with a bone, that it just wasn't the right story and we had to push on to find better ones. And I was not the right person to do it. I waited 3 decades, thought somebody else would do it. If nobody else does it, you should do it. Mm. That's what I think.
Mm-hmm. I think you probably had a sense at some point earlier in your life that you were a scholar, that you could write, you could communicate. But writing this, does this feel like sort of the capstone, or perhaps a capstone of your career, then? It sounds like perhaps that's true.
I think so. I think so. Although I have 8 folders, I'm looking at my wife. She already knows. I have a next book and another book, and I have 8 folders for other writing projects that I'll either do or not do, all focused on what does the world need and what should I do next. But this is clearly the kind of culmination of decades of thinking about things. 13 years is a long time to write a book. I mean, I basically wrote about a chapter a year because I had to stop and do things. So it is kind of the culmination of that. And I think part of in the 90s, some of you are too young to know and some of you weren't paying attention, but the book I published about retelling U.S. religious history, which I basically said, I don't know how to tell the story is, but I got some of my colleagues, and we all sort of tried to think, might new narratives look like? We didn't know the answer, and people would say, well, what, like what? And my answer is like this. So I feel like I've now sort of answered them, and if you don't like it, whatever, but I think this is another way to make it, to tell that story, and in that sense, it is a kind of culmination and a kind of really meaningful end to a long search.
Mm-hmm. Well, your lovely wife, Mimi, probably already has a sense, and it's wonderful that she's able to join us here tonight. But of those folders, Tom, which one seems to be calling the most? What's the next project for Tom Tweed?
Yeah, I probably shouldn't say, there's two. there's two of them, but I think both of them are different ways of trying to see if we can't come together more and be pulled apart less. There are two strategies for how to, in this particular historical moment, how we can bring Americans together. And I'll see which one wins, but I'm not sure. Nice try, though.
Yeah. Well, I love this book. I think I'm going to love the next one. I think it's really important and valuable to have. And could I? Are we? Sure. Questions? Absolutely.
Anybody has a question, I'll bring a mic over because there are people online and we want them to be able to hear. Again, if people are online and they want to ask a question, they can type it into the Q&A box. I'll start off with a question. And it is, last year or early this year, I believe, the most recent Pew Research survey came out that looks at America's belief systems, what people believe, what religions they affiliate with, and it had leveled off, but we have seen over the last 30 years a strong drop in religious affiliation and a large growth in people who consider themselves non-affiliated with a religion. When you look at a book like this and you're looking at this large history, how do you think that affects our culture?
The disaffiliation? Yeah. I mean, I think that's one of the things that wasn't in any other stories. And I wanted to get sort of village atheists. A lot of my students, I thought, were kind of spiritual but not religious. That if you went for coffee for a little bit, they kind of believed in some higher power. When bad things happened, they thought ritual worked, but they just were so suspicious about institutions for some good reasons. So I think part of what the story I trace here is how media communication technology is part of what changes it. And everyone here is aware of how communication technology sort of, you just don't learn all the information you need, and you only talk to a certain kind of folks. But the polarization that's come out is part of the issue. The other one is disaffiliation. And I think some of the people who are disaffiliated are leaving for really good reasons, and churches, synagogues, and mosques should pay attention to that. We haven't done a good enough job to listen to sincere doubting. So I think we should honor doubt, and that's sort of what I begin with as I sort of tell that story.
Other questions?
What happened to the Millerites, the religion that was convinced that it was the end of the world and they jumped from barns and trees? Did that religion mutate into something else? Are they still around?
Yeah, that's a great question. For the background, if this were when I taught for many years at Notre Dame, our classes, I would always begin with stupid question minute, like this is the chance for you to ask whatever you feel too embarrassed to ask. And that would be a great question about like what happened with them. It's wonderful. In 1840s, some guy decided he knew exactly the moment when the world was going to end. Now you can already see what's coming. It doesn't seem to have ended. And at that moment, some of the people, when the date came, thought, he's a fraud, I'm out of here. I mean, people stopped buying insurance, you know. And other folks said, well, something did happen, it just didn't happen in the way that you can perceive. And they went on to continue in a kind of tradition, an Adventist tradition that continues in some way. I think that's part of the disconfirming thing. One of the things we all are aware of is that belief seems so resistant to change, that people just seem to not change their mind much. So at that moment, some folks thought, yeah, the world didn't end the way you think it did, but Jesus has brought a new reality in the world, the first fruits of things, and now we can live out of it. So you get the sense that of the division, and some people just thought, I'm out of here.
We have a question from online from Judith. And it was, I mean, you've talked about how long this book took to write. She was asking about what was your research process for this particular book.
Like for many of you, the pandemic changed some of my research process. I was going to spend the summer in Oklahoma, and I was supposed to go hang out at Oxford and talk to people in environmental history. And so some of the stuff I was going to do, I couldn't do. But I basically I started chronologically and spent years figuring out where to start it. So I would just read voraciously. I would then ask humans. This is where bots don't work. You actually have to ask humans, so what's the best way to start the story? I would ask friends in indigenous studies, I would ask science, and so I would read everything I could about something for months. Sometimes I would spend, I cut 90,000 words in this book, by the way, it was longer. I went down all kinds of alleys and I thought, nice alley, love it, but we have to be gentler to the readers, we have to move it along. So I would do a lot of research, and then when I thought I was ready, I would then outline it, and then I would move section by section, and that usually took about a year for a chapter.
Other questions?
So I wonder why it's important to have a story and not multiple stories?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, what we did in 1997, it's a book called Retelling U.S. Religious History. It's from the University of California Press. I just wrote the introduction, invited people and said, go do it. Somebody said, we could tell the story from the perspective of sexuality, gender, and so on. And I think that was unsettling for lots of folks who were sort of older generation, I think. And I think there should be lots of stories. But what I actually think, and you'll all tell me if it's right, I think we all have a story in our head. Even if you don't believe in big stories, you all have a basic framework for how you think, when did it start, where did it start, and how does it proceed? You have stories in your head, so let's just get a better one out loud, and my assumption is that you'll find ways to do it better than this. The first public talk, I talked at local prison, and which was quite moving, and about the book. But the first one I did at a university, I ended by saying, okay, let's start writing the new one. And I just got the sense that people are thinking, it's not even out yet, and like, could we wait a second? But my thought is, let's write the next one, and let's have lots of stories. But I do think that there's a presupposition, we all have it, and we'll see them next year. If you think not, listen to the public conversation about the 250th anniversary of the country next year. There's going to be stories, and they're going to be competing stories. So my thought was, let me give a different one. But I'm happy to have lots of stories, and I hope that somebody here writes a better one than this.
Any other questions?
I should say, while the microphone's moving, that one of my mentors when I was a grad student said that the best books are the ones that promote conversation. And so it does not, I was writing about Simon Pokagon, and he said, it does not have to be the end all or be all. Just has to carry on that conversation, respond to what's written, make people think about what can be written. And I think you've done this with your book too.
I love that. In fact, in the earlier book about retelling U.S. religious history, I would say to people, if they asked me, everyone hated this, what's your goal? To fail generatively. Fail in a really productive way that provokes people to have more conversation. I hope this book fails generatively too. Yeah.
The overwhelming majority of Poles that immigrated to this country were Catholic, but there was a breakaway church called the Polish National Church. And what I heard was it was Poles that resented an Irish-dominated hierarchy. Is that true, or is that too simplistic of a origin story?
That's a really important question for Chicago, of course. I have a wonderful graduate student, Gavin Moulton, who is writing his dissertation about what he calls the Slavic Industrial Belt, which includes, of course, Chicago. And that will be the book to read about that. But I think he would say it had to do with lots of things. Some of it is all the priests were Irish Catholics or something. They didn't speak their language. They didn't understand their devotion. And it was tied with traditions in the old world. And it was about a control. And often what happened was corporations and church and pastors in some of the Slavic churches cooperated very closely, where the workers were left out. They weren't quite, even though Catholic social teaching said, we should care about a living wage, we should care about the dignity of the human person, they didn't always live up to that. So I think the reasons for splitting were about economics and politics and ethnicity and language and the kind of piety that they wanted.
I'll build on that kind of conversation about Chicago and Catholicism as long as we have your expertise here. And I'd like to tie it to the notion that we now have a Chicagoan as a pope. So as a final thought, when you look at this big story and some of these other issues, what do you think it means to have someone from America sitting in Rome?
Yeah, I mean, I'm Catholic, in case you didn't get that. I mean, it's moving, I think, to most American Catholics, although his numbers are going down a little bit among some Catholics. I think it's really significant at this historical moment. I didn't think we would see an American Pope for a while. And when he took the name Leo, nerds like me, I thought, that is really interesting. Why? The person who started Catholic social teaching, worrying about the industrial world and ordinary people, was named Leo. And I thought, maybe he wants to bring that together. So I think what Leo does, he builds on Francis's care about environment and goes back to the tradition of social teaching and actually understands the world in a complex way, because he didn't spend all of his time in North America. Of course, he was shaped in Latin America among the poor. So he seems like, to me, the best of both worlds, where he both understands ordinary people in the global South. He knows enough about North America and the US to speak to that. And he's thinking about what I call fiber optics in the next age. He's thinking about fiber. What's happening with AI? How do we think about public media? So I think he's a great pope for a really difficult moment.
Thank you very much. Can we give a round of applause to our wonderful guests tonight?
Thank you for listening to this episode from the American Writers Museum Podcast Network. Be sure to subscribe so you are notified when new episodes are released. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.